Okay, just doing a little comment over here. So, with regard to the inyan of Yosef and his brothers, please turn to Perkalana Zayin. Okay, the first two psukim, essentially Beis, Gimel, and Dalad, give you the outline, the foundations of the subsequent story. In other words, all of the things that are going to unfold. Tremendous story over here. You know, the circle of events. As I said, the Mechira of Yosef was brought about by two different sets of causes. One set of causes is human causes, and that is to say, to a certain extent, it's a result of what happens within the natural order. Yosef does certain things, Yaakov does certain things, this elicits certain responses, cause and effect. It's all a matter of cause and effect. It produces a profound hatred, animosity between Yosef and the brothers, and then events seem to take a course of their own. Yaakov, there's a lot of questions we can ask over here. Of course, the Torah does describe the build-up, it does describe the level of animosity, and what strikes me as being strange, I'll leave this, it's not for today, I'll leave you to think about that, is it seems that Yaakov is aware of it. Very interesting question. It seems that Yaakov is aware of the animosity that exists between the brothers. We have to question the role of Yaakov. Yaakov plays a very significant role. As I mentioned, Yaakov was the one who was hurt the most in the entire story over here. The Mechira, the intended victim was Yosef, but Yosef rises to the pinnacle of power. So Yosef is only hurt temporarily. The real victim is Yaakov. And then one has to ask, what did Yaakov do to deserve it? Or one can ask, that's a tough question, but what was Yaakov's role as a father in the events that occurred? Now we know that Yaakov made a serious mistake. And the mistake is pointed out in Pasuk Gimel. The Yisrael love is Yosef Mikolbono. That Yaakov loved Yosef more than all of his children. He had a favor. He then Zakunim love. But the reason is given. Clearly the reason is given. And Ben Zakunim is interesting. How would you take a look at Rashi? Take a look at Rashi. Finishing Rashi. What exactly does it mean, Ben Zakunim? Rashi, Ben Zakunim, Shenolad lo li'eis v'gnasar. He was born, that's the standard interpretation. He was born to him in his old age. The Unkelus again, Barachakim he was. And Unkelus interprets it in a different sense, because Zakain also is a reference to Misha Kanachachma. Okay? He had died to Pnei Zakain that you have to give honor in the presence of a zaken, an elder, means an elder, but it also means misha chachma, any kind of chachma. Koma shalomad mi shein ve'eva, everything which he learned from shein and eva, mosala, he gave over to him. So that's a different interpretation. Dalarachal, another pshat is, shahoye ziv ikunin shalom domalal, that the appearance, he looked like him. Now, what is difficult about this Rashi? It's important for us to study a little bit of methodology. What are you supposed to know? Pick and choose? Which, you got three explanations. Rashi's given three explanations. And, are they all true? I mean, is only one of them true? And what's the plain meaning of the prophecy that I just given you there? They seem to be very, very different types of reasons. You're telling me three distinct factors. One is old age, one is chachma, and the other one is appearance. Well, are they appropriate reasons? I mean, well, of course, Yaakov is our role model. We have to learn what's proper, even in terms of how we should control our relationship to children and so forth. Are they appropriate reasons? Now, what do you want to say, Ali? He says that two of the reasons really seem to be not worthy ones, not very worthy ones, for a person like that, but maybe for an ordinary person. And then those are the old age and the fact that he looked like him. The only one that makes sense, he says, is the one that Uncle is. Uncle is actually is the target. He translates it as Baruch Hashem. So it's an obvious question. So it seems though people don't have a problem with that. People do not seem to have a problem with that factor. Because most people, when they read it on a superficial level, it seems to make sense that a child of old age does have a special relationship. Ben Zikunin, a special love. That, as I said, that there is such a thing. The question that the Ramban asks is that if you're talking about the one who was born when he was older than me, that really should be the Yemen. That's the Ramban's question. But the idea, let's say there was no Binyan, forget about Binyan for a moment. The idea that a man has a child in old age, and that child is very precious to him, that seems to be something that most people accept. People wouldn't question that. And you'd ask, why? Why should that be any different than any other child? So you're asking really a psychological question, and it's something we can think about. But the question of the Ramban is a, practically speaking, a very strong question, because the if you're going to talk about that factor, so Binyamin should have this thing. That's a very interesting thing. The fact is, if you might think, the one factor which, again, would make sense to us would be the factor that it was the child of Rachel, and Rachel was the wife that he loved. So that would seem to give Yosef an advantage, yet that's not mentioned. I just caution you, all the factors, you see, when you're saying, what is this emotion of you? Of Ben Zikunin, and that is, as Noah's pointing out, which makes sense. Yeah, that when a person is past a certain age, he may begin to feel that he's fading away from the scene, or he's lost his virility, whatever the case may be, and then he has a child, and it restores that sense, whatever. That may or may not be true, but the only thing we have to be cautious, because we're talking about Yaakov Avinu, and you just can't attribute at this stage in his life, you can't attribute to him the ordinary emotions that motivate all people. Now, to a certain extent, he's an emotional being. We do see, on the other hand, we do see that he is subject to emotional favoritism. He loves his child. He has a favorite. He plays that. He plays favorite. So we have to be very, very careful. We can't treat him as though he were beyond human experience, as though he was some type of a thing, like the brain has. That is to say that he automatically does the good. That's a common mistake, in my opinion. On the other hand, you've got to be extremely careful. Because, he is different, he's perfected, and you can't just say, well, okay, I have this emotion, this is the way I would act, so obviously that's what he's acting, and you gotta be very careful. So it's not easy all the time. It's not easy all the time. I have a shot. The thing I would like to do is to try and understand Rashi, because Rashi's putting together three different things. And what is the point of putting together three different things? Well, for example, Avi's mentioning that parents have an emotion of living vicariously through their children. I think most of you have encountered that in one form or another. That's the root of it. Why do parents drive you so hard to be successful in certain areas and so on and so forth? Of course, they will never admit it. They'll always say it's for your benefit. But if it's a great for parents, it definitely identifies with the success of the child. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it could be. It could be a very bad thing. And you see extremes of that in our society today. The thing is, again, we have to beware. I don't know that this is true to apply to someone like Yaakov. A tzaddik never has to live vicariously, because a tzaddik is always living to the fullest extent in the present. And a tzaddik doesn't fear death. You see that? Well, it's one thing that the Torah makes it absolutely clear. When Yaakov is approaching death, he faces death squarely, and his only concern? Is the future of Klal Yisrael. And not only the future of Klal Yisrael, the future, even concerned about the Mitzvah, Alamot Tikkurein Mitzrayim, which is the Tupac, he wants it to be buried in the Yaakov Machpelah, because that was very, very important to the future of Klal Yisrael. But Rashi also brings down a shot over there, that one of his reasons was that he had the fear, because the fear that the Mitzrayim would worship his Kevin. Great. He did not want to be in any way a Michshol, a stumbling block to others. He didn't want to live That's an amazing thing. This is something, by the way, that does not affect the ordinary individual. Even a Talmud Chacham, or even a righteous person doesn't have to worry about things like this because he doesn't attain that type of a level of popularity. But someone who achieves a tremendous degree of adulation as a tzaddik has to be very careful that his grave should not turn into a sun. Thereby, in death, he could be a mishal. You see? You do see that. I mean, people go to the graves of tzaddik and so forth. Yeah, and they transform it into some type of a shrine. It really, it's borderline. It borders to a large extent on serious issues. Yaakov. Yeah, sometimes you can't help it. I mean, the Rambam, a person can't do anything about it. I mean, some of the Rambam's cover today, but also people with misguided ideas can now turn to the Rambam as a holy person and misuse it in that way. That's not the Rambam's fault. Certain things happen in the world, you can't control it. But to the extent that you could, you have an obligation to do so. That was Yaakov Avinu. No! He knew the mentality. How he knew that is amazing. But we see that he was correct, because he sees a tremendous amount of... I think in all of history, you don't see a greater expression of mourning for any individual that I'm aware of. In 70 days, 70 days of mourning, that's following the 40 days of the embalming. Following the 40 days of the embalming, 70 days of mourning, then they send up a tremendous delegation of all the dignitaries to travel. In those days, it's not like getting on an airplane. Clinton went to Rabin's funeral. That was a great show of respect. But basically, it means to go on an airplane, with all the modern conveniences, and it's a 12, 13-hour trip. Which is a big cover, no question. But then to travel from Mitzrayim to go through the desert and to travel to Canaan was an amazing thing. See, even then, they stopped and they cried. And, unbelievable expression of mourning. Where does it come from? So Yaakov apparently was correct. There wasn't tremendous danger. Therefore, what I'm saying is like this, to get back to the point, it's hard for me to think that he's the type of person that's going to live vicariously. It's hard to attribute this emotion to a tzaddik, because he's living in the present. He's not living vicariously. His concern with the future and with others is purely for their sake. L'man Hashem Yitzaveh, it's one of Acharav, to keep the Derech Hashem. His whole concern with the future is not because of the self, because of the ego. If that's the case, it would be limited to very few. He's concerned with the broad range, with the distant picture. Because even with those people that have no vicarious relationship to him, because he's completely involved in the Avodah Hashem. So therefore I reject that concept. But that was the basis for his Ahava, for the Yezbel. But I think what Rashi is telling you, you see, it's always good to step back and say, well, what does Rashi have to go? What was bothering Rashi? Rashi has to give three explanations for something which is not such a big problem for us in the first place. A lot of cases where we would like Rashi to explain if there's anything. And Rashi has to give you three reasons for something which is very simple. So one should ask a different question. Why does Rashi give so many reasons when I don't need so many reasons? So then you gotta take a step back and say, what was bothering Rashi? So Yoni is saying, why the fuck do you even have to tell you a reason altogether? Why don't you tell me like him? Yeah. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Not so much what was troubling Rashi, but what did Rashi undertake to accomplish over here? What is Rashi trying to do? And he's telling, as we said, it seems more than we need. We're content. We're content. He's trying to explain, this is a major, major catastrophe. A major, major mistake. And let's face it, everything that happens, and this is a serious... Everything's just wonderful, so it's hard to get back into that situation. Since it worked out wonderfully, we never thought it was a good problem in the first place. But in rest, what happens over here is a tremendous calamity. Tremendous calamity. Without the Ashkacha Hashem, what would have happened? In order to understand the calamity, let's try and imagine for a moment what would have happened without the Ashkach Hashem. If this were an ordinary people, you see, you don't appreciate all the factors that go into the making. We take them for granted. If this were an ordinary group of people, with a mission, with an objective, to set up a nation, and so on and so forth. But what does that make sense?
The real chet over here is that the actions of all the participants are such, above and beyond the immediate, that they engender hostility and mistreatment and so forth. That's the small picture. But in the big picture, what is everybody guilty of? They're breaking up the family. But the family is not a family. I mean, it's one thing breaking up a family. I'm not... Fine. But they're breaking up Kaisel. Because this family is a different kind of family. This is Kaisel's formation. So this is... In other words, by the actions that they're doing are very, very serious, because if we're going to assume that this is a very important period in the development of Klal Yisrael, which it is, it's the transitional phase. Yaakov is the last of the other. That's the first phase in the development of Klal Yisrael. The next phase is sort of an in-between. It's a transformation, and transformations are extremely, you have to know, if you know anything about developmental, whether it's psychology, whatever it is, that from a physical standpoint, the crucial, and a psychological, education, the crucial moments are those of transition. Okay? And everything is a transition, because once a person, first that's the way you develop, you know, you reach a certain phase, you solidify, you know, you're functioning okay, but then you have to move on to the next level. And that's when you're the most vulnerable, because you're giving up, you have to leave what you've been accustomed to, and you've got to learn something new. You have to take risks. You know, in your own life, I mean, transition. If you go on to get into high school, then once you're in high school, you're set, you're established, you're master position, you're doing fine, then you graduate. So that's it. Now you've got to leave that behind you. You got to go into a new situation. That's when you're most vulnerable. The same is true over here with the development of Klal Yisrael. It's one situation when you have a small unit of people, and you have the leading figure, the other. But now they're going, now they've got to go to a very serious transformation. How does that become a nation? You can't just start a nation. Now, we know that the plan of God was that God operates through the natural order. That the plan was that this nation should emerge through 12 units, each one of the shevet. But of course, that's because you have to have individuality in it. A nation can't just be one person. You've got to have different personalities. So each of the 12 shvatim were great, great leaders, great personalities, perfected individuals. Okay? That's why, the nation, what was the structure of the nation? It was Kahal Gayim, a congregation of nations. In a sense, it's similar. I mean, to what we have, like, this, I don't know if it works the same way, but I mean, it's like a union, a confederation of tribes. Here, instead of even the state, you have the tribes. Each one has to be fit to lead a tribe, and each tribe has its own specific purpose. It has to play a role. That's what you have in the brachos of Yaakov at the end of Vayechi. Now, why is it so involved in that? What's the point of these brachos? I mean, it goes into each shape. What is talents are, because that's the way God works, and God distributes the talents, in accordance, of course, with his infinite chacham, but each person has different capabilities. And each person has to deal with the talents, the combination of talents and such. And that's why no people tend to be envious, but nobody, don't look at somebody else. People always try to model themselves upon what the other guy has. Because all you see, what you see in the other guy is something which appeals to you, but you don't see the negative. You should focus on yourself. You should focus on yourself and try and get a better sense of what your talents are. The truth of the matter is, that's it. It's not going to change. You can improve. You can work with. But I mean, as long as you're engaged in envy, that's why envy is destructive. As long as you're engaged in envy, you feel you've been cheated, and the other it's destruction, an impossibility. God created you in accordance to, and in that sense, I believe the bracha that women say, Shasana Kritono, even though we don't say it, we say Shasana Isha for different reasons, but one can think that bracha of Shasana Kritono, because it has it was designated for women, but it has tremendous applicability for men as well. Because this is the truth, which is not only true for women, Shasana Kritono, it's true for men too. And that is to say that each person has to really be in touch with the kishronos that he was given, and to develop himself in accordance with God's will. And that can, as a person is honest with himself and he obtains genuine self-knowledge, and he's not lazy, and he's not jealous, and he's not complaining, why didn't I get this and why didn't I get that? Instead, concentrate on what you did get and develop it, then you'll have a happy life. And that's the idea of the shvatim. Each one of the shvatim, you see that there's God distributes kishrona. God is very bountiful, but he didn't give everything to one person. That's of course. But Moshe Rabbeinu is not even a result of, that's the only individual who said that his existence was predetermined by their stuff. He's going to clarify himself. Other than that, it's the infinite Chachma of Hashem, how he distributed the talents to different people. However, the sin qua non, the primary, the absolute condition is the unity. Now, that's very, very difficult because you have great people. And great people have independent ideas, independent judgments. That's what plagues, it took 400 years to leave Hananella. What plagues caused Israel in the period of the Shelton is what makes it clear. That's the theme throughout Shelton. Ish kala yoshem ein yasef. Hayam mehem ein melech to Israel. In those days there was no melech. Not to say, the Torah does have an ambivalent attitude about the melech as well. There's an ambivalent attitude. Melech has its negative features. But Ish kala yoshem ein yasef. That without the institution of melech, they were unable to subordinate the personal, the subjective agendas of the various shvatim, and a tremendous amount of independence and a lack of unity where necessary. They suffered greatly. But you see over here that the entire plan would have been destroyed. And these are great, great people. Because ultimately, the shape of the family of the year that's being depicted in Paras Vayeshev is the fact that they didn't put aside their personal agendas for the sake of Klal Yisrael, and they did the actions left to their own which would have destroyed Klal Yisrael, and the only reason it didn't happen was because of Shach Mashach, and the nation exists. I mean, this is not the end. It'll happen again and again and again, but you have to have an appreciation for that this is a nation which exists only because of the will of God. Even in the period of the greatest of our people, of the Avos and the Shifte Kah, so to speak, you see clearly, left to their own devices, then the entire thing would have fallen apart. So I believe that what Eli is saying and Yoni is saying is true, is that Rashi gives you, to see Yaakov Avinu, what we're going to be saying is, at this point, that Yaakov Avinu made a mistake. Very serious mistake. And one, he wasn't even aware of the significance of the mistake. And therefore, how do you explain it? How do you explain something like that? And the answer is that even a tzaddik on the level of Yaakov Avinu is a human being. And if the emotions are powerful enough, then they can lead to a decision. And therefore, but, that's what I'm saying. It's addressing, it's the very issue I raised at the beginning. How do we approach the understanding of the behavior of someone who's a tremendous tzaddik when it is clear that he is therefore I think that Rashi is giving you all the factors. When a tzaddik does make a mistake and it is because of a certain emotion, it can't be for trivial reasons, and that's why it has all the factors. Essentially, in my opinion, is what Uncle was saying. Uncle was taking the essentials, Bachasim. And I would say, I gave a shiur one time on Ben Zakunin, my own interpretation. And that is because, it seems to me, I could be wrong on this. I mean, there's a certain emotional thing, I guess it's a certain emotional factor. But it seems to me that perhaps when a person is younger, when a person has children is young, he's involved in two separate things. He still hasn't fulfilled all of his own objectives. Okay? He can't be completely... I see this happening practically day to day. You know, he has to spend a certain... He has to be concerned about the children, but he's still concerned about himself. He still hasn't First of all, he has to be engaged in his own whatever activities, if he's in a career, whatever the case is. Well, take the learning. He's still working, he's finding his own balance. He still hasn't achieved what he wants to achieve. So to a certain extent, there is a conflict. There's a conflict between the needs of the child and his own personal needs, especially if a person is in an area which demands a tremendous amount of energy. I mean, let's say he's on the level he's giving a big cheer, or he's a big rub, and people need him. I mean, there is a big problem from a practical standpoint, the children who are raised in those kind of families, where the parents are very much involved in the public, circle people. And I'm not justifying one side or the other, but the practical, to a large extent, children are being ignored. If they can't, they're spending so much time with other people's problems, they don't have enough time for their own. Now, it seems to me that Ben Zakunin, I'm suggesting a possibility, at this stage in his life, Yaakov had essentially, the person who reached this stage in his life where he's basically achieved, you know, his own objective. In terms of his learning, his tradition, I mean, his theories and so on and so forth. You see that in everybody. A person, most great thinkers go through a phase of growth, development, then the breakthrough, and then the stuff. And then it's just, you know, and after that, there's always modifications, but they're not constantly expanding. You can see, at a certain point in their life, they were making breakthroughs, expanding, et cetera, then setting up their system, and then that's it. And then afterwards, they're more or less like giving it over, they're teaching. It seems to me that it could be that Ben Zakunin, at this point in time, what Yaakov needed was someone to give over all of his questions. In his earlier years, he didn't have such a need. His need for children was different. His need was to learn Torah, to raise a family. He had to work. He had to accumulate the wealth. He occupied his own activities. But that was being very successful. He had met all of the basic challenges of his life. He's got Esav, and then running away, and then with Lavan, and then being married, and having children, and raising. And essentially, Vayeshev, this is the Vayeshev, Ben Chazal said, Tikei Shleshev Vishalv, he still wants to, you know, to, I wouldn't say to relax, but I mean like to now enjoy it, to be involved in the enjoyment of the Chachma, of what he had accomplished. And then Yosef comes along, and he had a tremendous ahava for Yosef. Now, what the Rashi is saying is that the way we function is multi-determined. In order for someone to have such a powerful love, we're not... That's the way the psyche works. The psyche is very complex. So you can have different abilities. You can like someone. You can like someone a lot. Right? You can love someone. You can love someone a little, you can love someone a lot. But when it happens that you form a very powerful, powerful attachment, you see like David Yonasan, like he loved him to Nafsho, you know, Nafsho, true of Nafsho. It can't just be one thing. The problem with a lot of the friendships and relationships you have, you see they come and they go, and then you move on in life, you have to, you know, it just happens, you can't help it. What's that? Even if it's not so, but a lot of times, you know, you move away, you get married, you have a job, you go to graduate school, you have to go to a different, you know, state, whatever it is. So occasionally, you may keep up with each other on the phone, sometimes you don't. But then there are certain types of friendship where you always, even if you're apart physically, you're always in communication. It's a very strong kind of a thing. If that's the case, it's something which is powerful on many, many levels. Especially so, in my opinion, for a person who is a Talmud Chacham, for a person who's involved in the world of ideas, it's almost impossible to imagine such a powerful emotional relationship that doesn't involve Chacham. Now that's a personal statement of my own. I just think it's true. But in general, every person, his friendship will be based, the real powerful ones will be based on those things that are closest to his heart. You're right. I'm not making a statement over here whether this is superior. I happen to think it is, but I'm not getting into that, because that's not our issue. I'm saying, however, for a Talmud Chacham, since Chacham is the essence of his life, then it's very difficult. It is very difficult to form very meaningful relationships with people that he can't share Chachma. You see, that's the problem. If I can't share my Chachma with someone, then what can I do? Then it's very limited. It's all superficial. Because since that's the essence of my life, and my real value, everything evolves from that. While I do enjoy other things, on so it's all stemming, there's a base there, it's all rooted in chachma. If I can't share that with the person, then we're very limited. It's a very superficial relationship. Point. I think what we said this morning over here is that this is an important, there's an important question which is not being stated as a question. And the question is, how could Yaakov Avinu be guilty of such a serious error? Chazal, by the way, Chazal learned lessons from this, that a person should never make any changes, should never show any favoritism to a child. It's a very serious mistake, because look what happened over here. Because of that one action, the Asalok, the son of Possum, he triggered off a series of events which were cataclysmic, which were destructive, which destroyed the ship they got. And Yaakov's whole life was dedicated to building it up. To building up ship they got. I mean, a serious tragedy over here. So, that's why it is multi-determined. It's multi-determined. It's rooted in Chachma, and I would say that the Ben Zakunim of Yaakov's old age, he's talking about the old age, fine, but study the old age of the Yaakov Avinu. In his old age, seems to me, this is a personal thing, you know, a person like that, at that stage in his life, the most wonderful thing would be to find someone who's given a good, yet it's not, apparently the other brothers, they were all coming to come, but not on the level of Yosef. Because it says he gave over the Torah of Shem and Eva. The Torah of Shem and Eva was the most advanced metaphysical. But apparently he gave it over only to Yosef. Yosef was in a class by himself among the brothers, on the highest level, intellectually. To find someone at this point in time that you could share that knowledge with, you see, and also that individual has all the other factors on the emotional plane. That is identification. That's the ultimate. I mean, let's face it. We're talking about friendship. We're talking about identification. This is identification to the highest degree, because the emotional and the philosophical come together. That's why he had an enormous love. But that became a challenge for him, a moral challenge. Since he's a tzaddik, and a tzaddik is never permitted to reach a point in the emotions where the emotions will distort his vision and cause him to make serious mistakes. So that it becomes an issue which you would call a chet. Now, the way I always interpret the pasuk is that there's nothing wrong, the Yisrael of is Yosef is Albanah. But there is nothing wrong that a parent does not have an obligation to love all of his children equally. Well, let me just pause on that and see if we all agree. I asked this question to a group of parents, and I asked this question for the first time, I think, to a group of kids, teenagers, which they'd be the most sensitive, you know, period in their life for this type of question. And then they asked a group of parents, are parents obligated to love all the children equally? In other words, is this entire passage a critique of Yaakov or not? So then let me ask you guys. Take the control. No. My question is like this. There's two, it's not so simple to answer. You're saying the answer is better than the fellow saying it's all, basically you can't control it. Well, that's debatable. That's not so simple to me. But still in all, it doesn't mean it's right. What if you can't control it? The question is it right? Or is it wrong? Should a parent strive? Is it the obligation of a parent to love all the children equally? Is that a parental obligation? Now, you could say that in many cases it's difficult or even impossible to do. So fine, those are the exceptions. But that's not my question, it's a question. It doesn't answer the question. The question is it correct? When that occurs, you know, that parent that is able to strive for that emotional balance and has the same emotional towards each child, do we say that that's correct, that's his obligation? Or do we say that it's not even an obligation? So I'm trying to avoid your answer. Your answer is only saying, well, how feasible is it? I'm not getting into feasibility. I'm going to throw this here. Let's say it was controlled. Okay? Let's say we control, because we have this brilliant therapist, psychologist, he can work it out. Are you obligated then to love? Is it an obligation? That's my question. Yeah. The question that arises, does a parent have an obligation even to love his child? What is the role of love in the parent-child relation? It seems like we're going very far from the whole world now. Everybody takes it for granted that parents look forward to having children, that it's a tremendous event in their life, it's a very happy event, and it seems like that's been Hagar Shalom. And yeah, parents naturally love their children. It seems to be part of a given order. And now, with the microscope of logic, you felt the same as saving obligation. Saving obligation. Okay, so what do you have to say about parental love altogether? What about the phenomenon itself? I mean, since you guys are philosophers and you're striving for perfection, and you can have children, and what are you going to do? What about your emotions? What are your emotions going to be? Now, this is a very, very serious question. A very serious question. In other words, what about the factor of parental love? Is that, how do we view it? And you guys simply say, well, it doesn't really, it's not that significant. I mean, it's an optional type of thing. What we're concerned about is how you treat the child. That's what you're saying. You need to say that there's no point in cultivating. Now, there are certain emotions that we maintain are good emotions, which of course have been reasoned, such as compassion. Now, you can't just say, well, either a person is compassionate or is not, because that's not the case. The Torah says you're supposed to work on yourself to develop compassion. There are certain emotions that have to be developed. Okay? Now, what does the Torah have to say about this emotion, parental love? Is that a good? Of course, it can be bad, obviously. I mean, in general, if it's within the proper limits, is that a good? Or according to you, what I'm hearing from you two, which is saying it's really indifferent, it's really irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Well, but the question we're asking you is that before you make such a decision, is that true? I mean, that parental love is simply something which the Torah is not concerned about one way or the other. In other words, I maintain, I'll have to try and elucidate it at length some other time, but I maintain that this clearly, I mean, that would be the goal. I mean, there'd be something wrong, something amiss. It seems to be that God's design that parents should love their children. Now, that doesn't always have, it doesn't mean if you don't, that it applies, but it doesn't mean that it applies to every particular case, because it doesn't mean that there are certain, just because someone's a child doesn't mean you have to love them. That also doesn't make sense, because did you see the kids and parents, their answer was no, the parent is not obligated to love each one equally. But they did maintain that a parent is not obligated to love the child. Just that they did permit them to have a favorite. But they said that the mistake was to show it. That was their answer. But parents, you get a different approach. Parents usually tend to maintain that you must love all, they love all their children equally. Most adults, see, adults are not as honest, in my opinion, as children. They have an agenda, and this is one of the hardest things. A parent will never admit that they have a favorite. Very rarely. They're very rare, exactly. And they deny it because they have them. I usually find parents much more tend to the idea that God forbid, you know, I have a favorite. I love all my children equally. All my grandchildren equally. That's what they maintain. Most average people feel guilty about having a favorite. They feel guilty about it. They feel that there's an obligation to love all children equally. Now, I maintain, like you fellows do, that there was nothing wrong with the fact that Yaakov had a favorite. Because, as you said, the Torah does not impinge on a person's private life. You have no right to impinge on a person's private emotional life. So I'm saying, like, in terms of friendship, for example, or in terms of love, you have no right to demand that another person like you. Because that's your own personal area where you have total freedom. You have a right, you have a claim in terms of seduction, in terms of sexual, but not in terms of friendship. In other words, I'm sure you've all had this case. It works both ways. If you want to get part of the group, sometimes you want somebody to be your friend, or you want a girl to be a girlfriend, whatever the case is, so you make your effort. And you either succeed or you get rejected. But when you get rejected, you know, you feel a little hurt, like it's something wrong. Like, I like this person so much, I'll do anything you want. You know, you assume automatically that since you feel that way, then it should be reciprocated. But I think you have to accept the fact that you don't have a right to make such a demand. The proof of that is because you'll always find yourself on the other side. When there are people, there are always going to be people that want you as their friend, right? Or girls that want you as their boyfriend, then you know you're not attracted to them. Now, I don't think you're gonna, if you're gonna be honest, then you're going to say that just like I don't accept the fact that I have to be this girl's boyfriend because she likes me, I don't like her. So then why the same way around? And you have to give that girl the same rights. And just like I'm not going to, I mean, I'll do a certain amount of seductive charity work, but I'm not going to go hang around with someone as a friend. Now my leisure time, and I want to go out and have fun. I want to go on vacation. I'm going to go out with this person because this person, I don't enjoy their company, but they're lonely, they have nobody. Just take them along. Right? I'm not going to accept that I have such an obligation, and then I have a right to my own personal emotional life. You see? So that's the case, and you have to get everybody else there. And therefore, you can't get upset. That's when you say to the brothers. See, the brothers couldn't tolerate the fact that Yaakov had a baby. Yaakov made a mistake, of course, in demonstrating this. He made a mistake. But the brothers still had the option of selective choice. And that is to say, they were hurt by this because they wanted to be the favorite. And it's extremely painful when you want somebody's love. Seriously, on a serious level. And you don't, not only don't you get it, that's one thing, that's painful enough. But somebody else, especially who you consider yourself to be better than, superior to, gets it, then the average person's going to wind up hating them. Unless you say, 1 second, that's their most choice. But how could she love this guy? I mean, like, he doesn't have my needles, he's mean, he's inconsiderate, he doesn't care about it. What all the factors are, you can argue from today to tomorrow. But the point is, why are you upset? Doesn't she have a right to her emotional life? She may be making a mistake, but that's not dumb at all. You're not concerned to save the world. So that's her life. But it's her emotional life. So why can't the brother say that, yeah, maybe Yaakov is wrong, but he has a right. He has a right to have his favorite. And that favorite doesn't have to be me. Just like I have a right to have my favorite, and I'm not relinquishing that right. Are you living your whole life on the basis that I'm not going to have any favorites? Are you living your life? No. No one's living their life that way. Everybody's going to live his life. And look, when it comes to your desire, when you find the favorite, and it's your desire, you can have the favorite. And they weren't upset with Yaakov. So you may be smarter, and you may not show it. Fine. But they weren't angry with Yaakov because he showed it. The showing of it revealed the fact that he loved it. So that's where they had guilty. They couldn't accept that. But their hate was that even though Yaakov made a mistake, even though it was very painful, and they were the victims, but they should have forgiven Yaakov. They should have said that he has a right to his own emotions. And that's an emotion. He has a right to his emotions. Everybody has a right to his emotions. Provided it's not hurting anybody else. He wasn't hurting anybody. Now, the wisdom we learn from it is that you've got to be extremely careful as parents, as community members, as teachers, as rabbeim, is the biggest mistake you make is when you gratify this emotion by showing your favorite. That's why Rashi has to explain how he makes such a huge mistake. It's multi-determined. Many, many factors. It's a huge mistake. I mean, you'll never get out of this. If you practice favoritism, and then you try and compensate in other ways, it's not going to work. And don't think you can fool people either. Children are very perceptive when their own very powerful emotions are involved. You think you got away with it. You think you faked them out, but you didn't fake them out. You can't fake it because people can sense it. There are certain things they can sense. When you single out that one, when you act differently, slightly differently towards the one you like, the other one picks up on it. And you, since you're oblivious, you think you're such a clever person, you assume that they didn't notice. They noticed. Because when people's own emotions are at stake, they're watching every nuance. And you can pick up on these things very, very quickly. Yeah. Two things that I have maintained are, I connect the Baruch HaKim to the Zakunim. In other words, at this stage of his life, this is exactly his greatest need. This would have been his greatest need in terms of a child. A child to whom he could give over. He could give over his most advanced stuff, no? So that's why he's Ben Zakunim. Comes at the right time for a child to have a child. Then there's the HaKim that they share, the actual sharing of this tremendous stuff. No? And then there's a very powerful, before you, for starters, already there's a very powerful identification. And the identification is reinforced on the emotional level as well. He looks, in other words, you see, he finds in Yosef, and I suppose that, you know, he finds in Yosef the one with whom he can identify the most. That's closeness. That's a relationship. The closeness, closeness is based upon identification. And it's certainly, if it's reinforced by the emotional, by the time, it also has to come about at a certain time in your life. Also, that's a very important factor in relationships. You know, when you're totally preoccupied with building up your own body of knowledge and ideas and so forth, then other people aren't that important anymore. You can't pour all your energy into the other person. Right? But then Zikunim is a time in life when you really can pour all of your energy into this person. So I don't believe it's losing vicariously. I reject that idea. So those are the three things. That's very, very powerful. But Yaakov had the obligation to be aware of it and not to act upon it. And therein lies the, so to speak, chait, if you want to use that term, of Yaakov, that he allowed it. He could control it, by the way. You have bechira. You can control the level of emotional involvement. You see? By the way, you have to maintain this. Let me just tell you another thing. As if you do become rabbis or psychologists, if you're involved in counseling people, this is a very, very big problem. There's even written up about it in the Jewish Week recently about the problem of this problem will exist. It's a big thing in our society. Of it happens in the helping professions in psychology, but there's an article about rabbis that are involved in a certain type of misconduct. Could be sexual misconduct with regard to their congregants, because today rabbis get very much involved in people's lives. And that was a very powerful figure. It's just like psychologists always have to be on guard. A psychologist must, an honest one, must be completely professional to not get involved emotionally in the person they're treating. Well, Freud was extremely machina. To a tremendous extent. He maintained that they cannot have any contact outside of the analytic session. But it's interesting, I mean, everybody criticizes him and he's abuse upon him. Nobody conforms to his very, very high standards. He maintains that you can't get interested in their private life at all. It's purely at the treatment. And any type of involvement in the person's private life, even if you're not doing it, so all the barriers are broken down. Doctors are capable of today, and rabbis are capable of today. I mean, the standards have really gone down. Very serious, serious things. But you have to be on guard. If you reach that point where you're actually, because people are placing themselves in a very vulnerable position. So what happens is, the person himself is not that professional in the area, and he has his own unfulfilled emotions. When he meets someone, it could be a girl or whatever, and he and she looks up to him as being this powerful figure, so then it's very rough, and he develops very strong feelings. And if he does, now, you're expected to be able to control those feelings, to know how to deal with those feelings. So you see, just because you're in a situation where feelings can develop doesn't mean you can't control them. You don't just assume that, well, it's not my fault. You allow them to develop. And at a certain point in time, when they're fully developed, then you can't do anything about it. Now, either you know how to deal with this. If you're a professional, you should have already been trained on how to deal with it. Or you have other colleagues who are professionals who help you in dealing with it. Or you remove yourself from the situation altogether. That's just in a psychological situation, as a therapist. In a rabbi situation, it's a matter of Hashem. To use that power that's conferred, you do have a power that's conferred upon you due to the situation that you're in, due to the authority that you have, you have a tremendous, tremendous obligation not to misuse it for personal benefit. And you've got to be very, very careful if you don't want to be involved in help, don't be involved in counseling. But once you do get involved in counseling, then you are subjected to many, many temptations. And you've got to be very careful. And if you don't understand, that's why you have to know. If you're going to get into this, you have to know a lot of psychology. You have to know when the person is manipulating you, is maneuvering you. And you have to be very honest about the emotions that are being elicited, and you have to know how to deal with them. If you can do so, you can be successful. But you cannot allow yourself ever to become part of the problem itself. You've always got to be above and beyond and aloof. Of course, it can be helpful and sympathetic in a different way, but in a very, very professional kind of way. So a person definitely can control, and the truth of the matter is that's what appearance has to be. A parent has to be aware of all the emotions that they have in the same way. And then to be honest, to acknowledge them, and then to separate what you feel from how you're going to relate to your various children. Because the truth of the matter is that, as I said, while philosophically you're entitled to your favorites, in your responsibility as a parent or teacher, you are not entitled to indulgence. You're not entitled to indulgence. That's why most parents deny that they have favorites, because they're afraid. They believe that you can't control it. They believe that you can't, that it's impossible to control. So therefore, if you're going to have a favorite, you're definitely going to show it. So therefore, the only solution is not to have a favorite. That's the reason why they give that answer in the first place. Back to Rashi's on the three explanations of Ben Zakunim, when Rashi says that they look alike, it's Yud Zakunim. Again, it's a play. It has to go back to the word. So the word Zakunim carries three implications then. Devaracha. Now, I don't think he's saying that they're arguing over here. It's a further thing. In other words, the Torah shows that one word that would carry so much, you see, so much of a basis, so many factors in one word, to explain to us that that's crucial. The question is, how did Yaakov make a mistake like this? It's got to be a very powerful cause. The Torah conveys that through the word Zakunim, Ben Zakunim, and the word Zakunim carries three very significant bases for that type of a powerful relationship. Okay, now we come to the issue of Yosef. The picture of the character of Yosef, and of course, essentially we're supposed to see the defect. Yosef was 17 years old, so as I said yesterday, I mean, he wasn't, no one is perfect by nature, is naturally perfected. Everybody, no matter how great he is, insofar as he's a human being, he's going to have emotional areas that he has to work on. We shouldn't imagine otherwise. Now, it says that he was 17 and he would graze with the sheep, herd and shepherd the sheep with his brothers. And then it says the hunah. Now that's an important term, the hunah. You see? Because why? Because Tirei told us that he's 17, so clearly it's telling us something about him. And Rashi says, Tirei Osamai Sanara. That he did the youthful types of things. There was immature kinds of things. Masaki and Masaro, Ramash Meshka, today she and Nira Yacha. In other words, he was concerned about his appearance. He wanted to be, he was obviously good looking, but he was, well, the fact that he was good looking is a meaningless thing. It means to say that he was preoccupied, as young people are, with a certain vanity. Okay? Then it says, Estanei Bilha Vi Estanei Zilpa, Mishayavu. And Rashi takes that to mean that he would, he was with. He would associate with the children of Bilha and Zilpa, who were the Shifcha. So, according to Rashi, he did that to bring, to be friendly to them, because they were sort of like put down. The other brothers, to a certain extent, put them down. Because they were the children of the Shvacha. They didn't regard them on the same level as themselves. That's the B'nai Leia. You have like two factions. You have the B'nai Leia, then you have the Shvacha. The B'nai Shvacha. Rashi says that they would, that's where Rashi learned, that they would sort of, degrade them, mistreat them, and who Humakarvan. That would seem to be a positive thing. Because of Rashi, that was Rashi, Humakarvan. The pasuk is telling us a lot of different things about him. Some of them are negative, but some of them are positive. It's important because you can't take anything out of context. Everything has to be studied in context. Yosef is a great individual, so be careful. Even though we're telling you that he has certain defects, but you have to know how to interpret it properly. But what's the most troubling of all, it seems to me, what seems to be the most critical statement that's made about him, by Yove Yosef as the Bosom Roy Alaviyam. Then it tells you that Yosef brought back their report to his father. Now, the first part that he was in on, that he suffered from vanity in terms of his looks, that doesn't strike us as being so terrible and or unexpected. Because as I said, even great people have to go through a process. A development is a certain type of maturation process. And as I tried to explain that intellectually, a person could be a genius, precocious, you can find it at a very young age. But question. That's very hard. In mind, because great mental achievement, after all, is a talent. Some people have talent, and a person has a fantastic mind and precocious development. But moral perfection is something that just takes a certain amount of time and struggle and effort and growing up. It's just it's so inextricably bound up with being young that it's impossible that a person's moral perfection should keep up with his intellectual. The intellectual perfection usually goes much quicker, earlier, in somebody who has the qualities, in the genius. If you have a child prodigy, you have a prodigy more in the intellectual than in the moral. That's very, very difficult. But what's troubling is this latter thing, that he brought back an evil report. That smacks as being something very serious. A serious flaw, because it seems on the surface that he was engaged in Lashon Hara. Now, as I said, at 17, you don't expect a person to have conquered all of his emotions. True. And especially something like vanity. That's so deeply ingrained in the psyche, you know. It's hard, even sometimes a person's not even aware that he has it. Everybody has this feeling of egotism and so forth. Yeah, but he can control his behavior. The wise is the tzaddikim, by the time they were 17, and I don't think they were talking like that. That's a serious flaw. Okay, but I want to today to study a very difficult Rashi, a Rashi Kamua. Kamua Ma'od, in my opinion. Perhaps one of the most complicated Rashi's of his general year. So let's take a look at Rashi, Eshi Basam Ra. Rashi says, Kol Ra, Shahi Roa, for Echa of Bnei Leah. Any evil, alright, that he saw in his brothers, the Bnei Leah, he's talking about. Hayamagad Leah, he tells father. First, he says, not just, he didn't tell you the specifics, just in general, anytime he saw something bad, something evil, he would report it. Shayyaofan, Avram, and Achai. Then Rashi goes in particular, that they ate Avram and Achai. That was one thing he told them. In Mazal's wind of Nashbachos, but gross and avodim. And they would degrade, make fun out of the children of the Shbachos, calling them slaves. B'chashudin al harayot. And also that they were suspect concerning harayot, forbidden sexual relations. Pretty serious stuff. B'vishlosh and lacha. And all three he was punished. How so? Alev Menachai, concerning Yev Menachai, it says further on, by Yishchatu Se'eriz and Bimachirata. When they sold them, they actually slaughtered a goat, Veloach Ruchai, and then Yerichai. The Alvar Shesiper Alem Shekor Lachem Avon, and concerning the matter that he snitched, saying that they called the brother of Adam, their brother of Adam, Le'eved in Koyosef, he was always an Eved. V'chol V'arayos Shishi Pralayim, and concerning the factor of Arayos, Batisa Eishas Adonai. We learn later on that the wife of Potiphar attempted to seduce him, and he got into trouble over that. Okay, such is the Rashi. Now, what are the problems? The question, I think, is that Rabbi is an ironclad question. These are very serious accusations. And therefore, we have to pause and ask ourselves, were they true or not? Were they true? Now, either way you go, it's going to be very difficult. Because if they were indeed true, so then what was your why was just fulfilling the wrong thing? Aren't you supposed to? I mean, I know everybody has a very powerful emotion against snitching. It's something rad and so on and so forth. That's deeply ingrained within us. But you see, there are certain times when it's obligatory. You can't just follow your emotions. You have to. It is a negative thing, by the way. Even you have an interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin. When Yeshua complains, when the Jews are defeated, when they sought to conquer Ai, the city of Ai. So then God told them, Chata Yisrael, and so on and so forth. And they took from the and so forth. So then Yeshua said, they asked God to tell me who they were and I'll punish them. And God, in the Gemara, according to God says, Am I like a tattletale? Am I expecting to be a snitcher? So therefore, then he had to cast lots, and the lot, you know, they found there was all kinds. Interesting idea. I mean, but the lots themselves operate to, you know, through Ashkacha. So God is dealing. Yeah, but it means to say that God, when he interacts with us, always interacts in a manner, you see, that reflects perfection. Of course, as far as God is concerned, it's not a matter of God's beyond that. We don't take it literally, but it means to say that there's an idea there. So, in general, when snitching is a negative thing. We have to explain, but there are certain circumstances we are obligated. I mean, if a person commits a crime, how does Bezner find out about it? They didn't come forth. They're obligated to come and tell. And in many situations when you know that someone is doing things that are very harmful, and you refrain from reporting it to the proper authorities, so then you're guilty. That's sinful, because you're permitting it to proceed. Either a person is harming himself by living a dangerous lifestyle, or he's harming others, or he's maybe involved in Chol Hashem. So even though I know it's a very powerful emotion, everybody has that emotion, they hate to be the snitcher. But you have to realize why it's a bad thing to snitch in general, and in what situations it's bad. But then you also have to realize in what situations it becomes obligatory. If we say that it was true that they were doing these things, then we have many, many problems. First of all, then what's our view of the brothers? Our assumption is, we're working with a certain assumption, right, even though the Torah doesn't say it explicitly, but we know later on that all these were B'nai Yaakov, that these individuals were great individuals, and they all, in the last analysis, became the leaders of the Jewish people, and they received the brachos of Yaakov. So you're talking about what we refer to as the Shift Deko, we're talking about great people. So even the mistakes that they may make have to be commensurate with great people. For example, when you encounter later on Yehuda, and the incident with Tama, that's a case in point. The incident in Tama. Now if you read the story superficially, so it seems that this person is not an exceedingly moral individual. Because his wife has died. Okay, so he's not married, he's single. But he's out there at the shearing of the sheep, and then he encounters a prostitute, and doesn't seem to be a good problem. He just he doesn't have the money with him, so he gives her a security. All right, whatever. And then he has relations with her by the side of the road. So if you read the story, you know, superficially, you ask, what was the moral level of Yehuda? What was he doing? I mean, did he have observe the at least the 7 Noah Chad laws and so on and so forth? I mean, did he simply consort with prostitutes? He himself later on says when his friend comes back because he wants to redeem the pledge, because it was his staff and his ring that gave away who he was, that Penny Elavuz, that just forget about the whole thing, because if the word gets out, it'll be an embarrassment. So. But of course, if you read the Rambam, if you understand what the halakha was, the truth of the matter was that before Sinai, everything he was doing was completely mutter. That the Rama makes it clear that before Sinai, it was mutter. A person would meet a woman and make an arrangement with her and have a relationship with her, and it was totally mutter. It's only after the Torah was given that that's considered to be a kedusha. Now I'm holding this as kedusha. This is a form of mutter. But before Sinai, it was totally mutter. So therefore we know that the Yehuda now is operating in line with the halakha of the time. It's entirely appropriate. He's doing absolutely nothing wrong. I know people have a problem with that because they're operating in certain emotions. But if you put that aside and you look at the facts, you see that he's doing nothing wrong. So that shows us that we're talking about people that were operating in accordance with the system. And that's the way the system was at the time. If that's the case, so what's going on over here? Now Yosef is bringing back evil reports. The types of reports are very damaging. Abel ben Achai is the most serious of all, because that's one of the seven mitzvot. Abel ben Achai, ben Noach, would be Chayav Nisa. Because if he breaks one of the seven, he's Chayav Nisa. Now, how could the brothers have been guilty of such conduct? Why would Yosef be punished then for reporting such conduct? And why, another strange thing would be, is why? Why wouldn't Yaakov do something about it? We do not find that Yaakov does anything at all about it. one side. That's the one side of the Yeronishah problem, of the dilemma that we have. On the other hand, we're going to say that they did not do it, and that would explain why Yaakov didn't do anything, because he wasn't Jew, they weren't doing anything. And that might explain why Yosef was punished, but then you have a very serious problem, and then what's the problem? And what are we going to think about Yosef? Is he delusional? Either he was delusional, or else he was just making up stories. And that is different. That is a very... Then Joe Dickey of the lowest level of Lashon Hara, I mean, just to make up stories that aren't even true, then I can't understand Yosef at all. You follow? So that is the dilemma that you have when you deal with this Rashi. After all said and done, we can't just focus on the particulars. We have to sit back into the puzzle. Okay, this is the drush, and it's illustrating for us the type of things that he might speak about. The type of zebra that he was engaged in. Okay? Alright. But how does it go back? So what's the point then? What does it tell us about Yosef? And why would, and also this funny nature of the punishment. I mean, is this the reason? The reason why he was sold as an Eved seems to be something different. And the reason why the Eishes Adonav, you know, tried to seduce him is just, are these direct reasons? And so forth. How does it work? Neither can I get, you know, because he said that they were, that they called them Shvachos, definitely he was sold as an Eved. What's the connection? Definitely he was sold as an Eved. I mean, it's like a, how do you see the connection? Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's see if we can understand what was going on. The thing is like this. Right, so let's take a look at the Sifrei Chachamim. The first question we have to resolve is, did the brothers do these things, or did they do these things? That's the first thing. So the issue of when you have an obligation to report, and when it's simply Lashon Hara, or it's none of your business, I mean, I can't give a set of rules at this point in time. There are certain things that it's none of your business. For example, if you happen to know that you have a friend and his parents have restricted him, they've grounded him, so to speak, and he's breaking their rules. He sneaks out of the house, he goes to the movies, wherever it is. So that's all it is. And then you go and snitch. I think that's a big case of snitching. You see, your only motive over there is to get another guy in trouble. It's none of your business. That's the kind of thing where I think it's a matter between him and his parents, and it's none of your business. Okay, I think you could all see that. If one were to snitch in that case, that would be a bad thing to do. You're just getting somebody else in trouble. On the other hand, if it's serious, if you see that the person is leaving and sleeping down on Shabbos and he's being with Chal Shabbos and he's running around with a bad crowd and he's smoking and he's drinking and whatever, partying, his parents have no idea whatsoever, and he's really going off into a dangerous situation, then I think quite the contrary. Who you tell, I don't know if you go to that. You have to consider it, but I guess you would go to some authority. You might go to the principal of your school or whatever, your rabbi, I mean. To just sit back and not inform would be the wrong thing to do. So I'm not... Now, where do you draw the line? That's not our point over here. In this case would be, if it is true that what he was saying in his family, where, you know, perfection and mitzvot is so important, then I think that if it's true, the brothers are engaged in these activities, so what's Yosef to do? Just ignore it? Then one wonders that how can Yaakov simply ignore it? If it is true. On the other hand, if it's not true, so then you have the problem that it's a very serious defect. It's much, much worse. Okay, so somehow or other, we've got to try and make sense out of it. Alright, now the first question we have to answer is, was Yosef making it up? I think the Rashi itself tells you what the answer is. It says, call Rosh Hayarela. It says that he saw. So apparently he did see. Okay. Now, let's put aside the Sifrei Chachamim for a moment. In this type of a Rashi, to try and make sense out of it, I try to avoid getting too much into this specific. And just give a general idea of what might have made sense, what might make sense. Because when you get into the particulars too much, it becomes very difficult. But I think the particulars that these specific Chachamim mention are interesting because they show you how this type of thing, how an appearance of chet is possible. You see? Where, in fact, no chet is happening at all. That's something that we have to live with, by the way. And it's very, very important. you know, there are cases where a person has done nothing. There are cases where a person has done everything, I think. But by and large, the most, you know, the most frequent case, I think, is the case of appearance. People get into trouble a lot of times because of appearances. They engage in certain activities which leave them, they leave themselves vulnerable. They leave themselves vulnerable because among people who are willing to give you the benefit of the doubt, you're okay. Among people who are not out to get you. But when among people who are out to get you, you see, you gotta know that you got the extreme, which are like the press today. The press is not out to help you. They sell papers because of scandal. So therefore, very often, they'll take things out of context. And they will try and make a case to condemn you. Okay? Now, they can't do so if you speak and claim. It's very, very hard. Although that happens too. Because one guy would say like this, he saw, there are certain things that he saw, but then you have to, even Yosef, it's how you interpret what you see. Now, I agree with the sister of him, if the things that he was seeing were so blatant, and it would be strange if they were doing all right, because, you know, in front of him, they're not going to be doing it in front of him. If they were doing Abram and Achai, literally, and Dad likes to do going over to a chicken and pulling off a wing while it's alive, that's clearly not what they were doing. Okay? The easiest case to understand, one accusation is interesting, because what was the accusation? They're chashun. It's not even saying they didn't. That's not even saying that they didn't. What does it mean? You're suspect. I accuse you of being suspect, all right. Well, what kind of a thing is that? You have to be a little bit careful, even with the Sifrei Chacham. You know, say there are certain cases that, technically speaking, are not Eved Menachai, but appear to be Eved Menachai. Okay? Then you do expect that Yosef at least to get the facts straight, look into it. So why didn't he get the facts? He really knew the technicality too. You know? So it's not that simple. It's still a problem for us. I would say, let's take the case of Chashur El Harayah. Chashur El Harayah, you know, sometimes a person, this is something that we all can relate to. Sometimes a person has a reputation, and to a certain extent, I mean, you know, he's responsible, but he hasn't done, it's just fault, a bad rap. Sometimes guys, and even sometimes girls, like, you know, a lot of times a person gets a reputation of being loose. Because of externals, because of behavior, because of who they're seen with, because of when they're seen, okay? And it could be completely false. It could just be, and very often it's a matter of usefulness. In usefulness, people do a lot of things. They're unconventional. When people get older, that's when they become very socially conscious. They become extremely conventional. But when you're kids, you don't care about these things. So sometimes the chashad is based upon the reality. But sometimes the chashad is not based on the reality. It's just based upon appearance, and it's just not true. But even that, you have to be very aware of this. That's why I say yeshiva guys have to be mocked in the other. Very important. Because the capacity for people to really distort and to pin a label on you that they would like to pin on you based upon a few isolated things is very, very... Don't ever, ever... overestimate the sense of fairness, fair play that people have. It's very soon that they're all out to get you. When you conduct yourselves in the public arena, and what you say, and how you hang out, and how you look, and all that, assume the worst. It can be very innocent. Sometimes, you know, you want to have some fun. You're a young guy, just that. You want to say you wear some funky kind of clothing. You know, you want to have this funky look. Hey, what's so terrible? Truth is between me and you, what is so terrible? You say, well, as when we're young, we all do crazy things. As long as they're not, we're not talking about cheating, no one's doing crimes, we're not talking about drugs, we're talking about, you know, you put on a crazy looking hat, you nod, you know, you get a little scared, you act a little cuckoo. It's nothing, it's anything, in my opinion. The only thing is, I know people. People love to gossip. Someone saw you in the bathroom. You've been from the village, you're carrying on, And then that's the first element. Anything that's told over, you know, down, what's it do with the game telephone, whatever it's called? Anything that's told over four times is completely distorted. Anyway, you know which way you... And some of the story is just right, and now it's juicy. You see what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying at the Mutarashkel, that you guys, in your own minds, now it could be, to a certain extent, you do enjoy that, the shock value. You're not entirely innocent, because you do love to create the feeling of shock and to give people that false impression, because then you can say, aha, you were wrong, I never did anything. Just look, there are people that do that, believe me, I know the evil that lurks in the heart of man. And I know that there's, on both sides, there's bad intentions. Because you want to shock people, and then you also want to shock them, and you also want to make fools out of them by showing them afterwards, aha, you suspected me of what? I ain't doing it. There is that desire. Okay. So you're not entirely innocent victim to it. You've brought it on yourself. But you should be aware, but there are certain times when you do things that aren't, you don't do it with that intention, and they're nothing really necessarily bad, but it's enough grist for the mill, so to speak. It's enough for those people, and that's basically the world, that are there to criticize, that are looking for that. They want to criticize. Okay. Now, in the case of Yosef, I don't think that was Yosef. I don't think Yosef wanted to criticize. Because Yosef is a tzaddik. But especially, I would say like this, I would agree with C.D. I don't know exactly. The brothers were young at this time as well. And they were engaged in certain types of activities, obviously with women. Okay? And they may not have been that machmir. In that, when I say not machmir, they've learned a lot. But the appearance factor, they may not have been, because they were high-level individuals, and they knew what they were doing. You see? In other words, let's take something like Jesus. Okay. Now, if it's not a good thing, if people are going to, not watch out for you, sort of, to be alone with women in certain situations, they could get a certain impression. Yeah, but first to be a tzaddik gomer. I mean, to be meeting with girls and helping them with business issues or whatever the case may be. The point is, now, what? Yeah, it's not the norm. You're going to say that question all right. It's chashad. You see? So I would say that in this situation, it means the chait of Yosef over here, exactly as Mark said, is that he wasn't Thomas Hafkos. In other words, clearly, Yosef was designed to be the leader. That's why these defects that are manifested over here have to do with his role as leader. And they're sticking to the puzzle. In other words, when a person is on a very high level, okay, he tends to demand, he's not sympathetic to human weaknesses. And that's something you have to be on guard against. He expects everybody to be on his own level of profession. Like people that are exceedingly medoctic and halakhic. So they tend to look down upon people that are not as medoctic as they are. But it doesn't mean that they're not doing a mitzvah or they're not doing it properly. But a mistake they make is that they try to impose their own personal level of being medoctic on others. To the extent where it can distort their view of others. In other words, it means that Yosef here had a distorted view of his brother, which was based upon the fact that he was in a very high level and was basically unsympathetic to their own particular situation. In other words, I am maintaining then, like this is from, that at least on two counts, with regard to Avram and Achai, they weren't guilty of Avram and Achai. However, the Avram Achai is a mitzvah. Apparently, Yosef was saying you have to go to the Medaktik of mitzvah. How do you go about performing a mitzvah? So I'm saying that basically he was critical of them, but they weren't sufficient to Medaktik. Maybe there were certain times, certain situations in the field where they were in a hurry and they had to do something, they stopped quickly from the meal, and there, that's what the future, the situation indicates to us that he was wrong. We see that they, later on, they shechted the Gedizim and so on and so forth, and they didn't eat Achai. I mean, he was wrong. However, in this situation, he was critical of the fact that they did not see the Mr. Prophet. They said, that's why you're over on Ibn Achai. In other words, they basically, a person has to, there's many Siyadim. A person should observe the Siyad. Right? The Gedda. Now, if a person does not do so, of course now we have the Rabbanan. But if he doesn't sit the Rabbanan, which was designed to protect against the Diyaraita, that doesn't mean he's violating the Diyaraita. But if he's not observing them, it's for sure that he's going to violate. It's like he's already over Eivor Nachayim. In other words, in his mind, you see. Now the brothers may have been right, and we're not going into that, whether they were right or whether they were wrong and what they did, but clearly I'm saying they weren't over on Eivor Nachayim, but to Yosef, this reflects the way in which he looked at them. And this was wrong. Because as a leader, he has to have a more sympathetic. In other words, he's distorted. The case of Eivor Nachayim shows that he distorted the situation. Due to this factor, due to this feeling of superiority and this lack of sympathy for the situation of somebody else, and as I said, very religious people usually have this type of thing. They're very unsympathetic and they expect everybody to be on their level of observance. That caused a distortion of the situation. And in terms of chashad, I would say that's pretty similar, but maybe slightly different. In other words, a leader has to be down the cup. What about down the cup for? Because all he saw were certain situations which could be interpreted in different ways. He didn't have, if this was a case where it was absolutely wrong what they were doing, I maintain, then the Yaakov would have done something about it. Again, our riot is very, very serious. Now, to prove that I'm to substantiate my approach here, the Rashi mentions that as a result of what he did here, certain things occurred to him later on. Now, I think when they do occur to him, that's not the primary reason, but I've explained in the difference here that sometimes a thing could be caused by a primary reason, but God will also utilize it to address itself to a secondary issue. So I explained the fact that Yaakov has been separated from Yosef for 22 years, because he didn't do keep it up for 22 years, right? And he said, well, one second, there was no, well, how was that in Avera? So I said, it wasn't. The real reason he was separated was because of the mistakes he made over here. But once God, that's the primary, but once God is punishing on the primary level, then God will also incorporate secondary and tertiary things, which in and of themselves would not have been sufficient to bring it about. You see? That's why I used the answer over here. I gave it over anyway. Let's take a look. What was the punishment on the level at which Rashi is interpreting it? For the accusation that he was a chashal haraya. Why did he find himself in the exact same situation? Batista Asia said, it's a perfect, what happened over there? He was totally innocent. He was totally innocent, and yet, he did not separate himself from the situation. He allowed himself to get caught up in a situation which, to all intents and purposes, from the visual standpoint, would be one where people would say, let's say he's guilty. Because he came into the house, right? And then he runs away, he leaves his garment behind, right? So, to all intents and purposes, he had no defense. He was crushed, all right. And then, so don't you see from this that a person can be in the most incriminating situation and be totally innocent with a topic by your mind? You see? So that shows clearly, I think, that is exactly what he was doing with the brother. He was refusing to be Damakar Kut. Because the person could have been down the Kafkos. Another individual who was the master of Yosef could have made the investigation and could have gotten all the facts of the story and find out all the background of Yosef and put together the accusation in context and come to a totally different conclusion. Yosef's unwillingness to do so, his hastiness in coming to a conclusion, and his failure to give the brothers the benefit of the doubt indicates a certain sense of superiority and a lack of sympathy for the weakness of other human beings. That is something that great people always have to be careful about. Where do you find another example of this in the Torah? Everybody has their challenges. Ordinary people, and great people do. Sometimes their very greatness, gives them a certain predisposition in how they judge others, which itself becomes a problem. Where do you see this? By Moshe Rabbeinu, you see it in a number of cases. I think the most striking case you see it is when Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Behem lo yaminu li, lo yishmi." Moshe, now, on a plain level, it meant, it's not the plain meaning, he wasn't accusing them. But Chazal take it to mean something deeper. And that's why the idea of the Maka turns into a Nachash. Because of Diva, and the second one, his hand temporarily, momentarily becomes leprous. Hara, because of Lashon Hara. Chazal says he spoke Lashon Hara against Diva. See? And then later on, when the prophet says, Vayamein Ha'am, So the Chazal say, you see, you're wrong, Moshe. They're ma'amin and b'nei ma'amin. Which means that Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't think this means overtly. Because overtly he wasn't saying that they're not believing. He was saying, I need the proof. And again, if it was Lashon Hara, then he should have gotten a full-fledged punishment just like Miriam did. So it was all Derech Remez, you see? But it does mean that Moshe Rabbeinu was lacking in confidence. And he didn't have confidence. And that's why it was pointed out to him. That was the purpose of those punishments. Because a leader cannot be successful unless he has an accurate assessment of the people. And part of that accurate assessment means he cannot come to hasty conclusions. That's a mistake that Rebbeim make a lot. They just look at the superficial, these other students. Certain students are terrific, they're day one, they're learning gun targets. And other guys are kind of lazy and they're rebellious and so on and so forth. And they tend to get written off. And that's it. In other words, they're pretty much categorical in their judgment. They fail to see that there's deeper qualities. You have to have a certain sympathetic understanding of the other person as well, and a certain confidence in him. If you write it right away, if you're saying he's, that's it, you underestimate his ability, so then that's going to be very bad. Now here, in my opinion, it all ties in together. I would say, what about the thing of Rizal's when with Nash Fakhar? That's a little bit tough. The easiest one to understand is the Chashid case, because then the punishment, according to Rashi, seems to fit, neither can neither. The case of the Eiver Min Achai is good in that it illustrates, you see, that here's a clear-cut case where they were in a hurry and they wanted to kill it even for just for the sake of blood, and yet they waited until it died. I mean, they shechted it properly, they did treat it properly, which shows that he was wrong, that he had misjudged. He had destroyed the situation. The practical problem has been raised. It seems from the story that occurs after he's already gone, so how does that affect him? Okay, but I'm not concerned about that right now. No, if it occurs while he's there, I say, no. That looks very good. But then he sees there's a creative situation where he's forced to witness the entire thing firsthand, and then he sees that the buddy said was wrong about him. That he was wrong about them. That would be the easiest. If you could tell me that he observes, he's aware of what's happening, that indeed they do, he accused them, once he saw that they weren't being machmir, according to the standards that he set, therefore they don't keep Allah. Now you see that now it's possible that a person isn't that machmir, there's different types of people out there, but they do keep the halacha. Very important, I know people write people off very quickly, on the basis of these things. You know, very quickly, he doesn't get up in time, the minion, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that properly, he missed my fish. Therefore the father writes up the time. He goes with an absolute denunciation. But what's happening? It's not so simple. Maybe he gets up late, but he manages just to get in right at the edge. He shouldn't live at the edge, and he makes monthly. Shouldn't do so. But don't be so quick. In your mind, if a person isn't doing it properly, exactly the way it should be done, the way it should be done. So therefore, you distort the situation. That's a distortion. You still know his mission. Maybe it's nice to the fact that he's not so machmir, but he really, when it comes to the actual halacha, gets it. I think the toughest one is the one about the accusation that they call the B'nai HaShpachos Avodah. And they also say that that's why he was sold as an Eved. But is that the real reason why he was sold as an Eved? That seems to be a stretch. I mean, the reason that we've given, the reason why was he sold as an Eved, is because that was the fitting, so to speak, situation of punishment due to the defect from which he suffered, and that was an overestimation of the self, which, great as he was, I mean, on his level, that's something that had to be addressed, so that was very humbling. He was broken down, his whole ego was broken down. That was, and not only that, but it came about in a way where he could see how his own mistake. It wasn't just that he was sold as a slave, but he was sold as a slave by his brothers, and his relationship with his brothers was the key. You see, that was the key arena of his mistake. In other words, that's exactly what you see in all the mistakes that he made, and how he related to them, in the fact that he told them the dreams. He insisted on how every move that he made was only making matters worse. So how can you be the great leader if you're making one mistake after the other with the people? You're totally misjudging the people. He never got it. He could never imagine that they had this hostility against him, because he just took it for granted that he'd be recognized as being superior. He clearly distorted their nature. the whole situation, their relationship to him. That's another thing that great people make a mistake on. They assume that because they are great, and they're aware of it, that they assume that everybody looks at them in the same way. You see? So that's why he was told as an ever. Here it's saying for this particular, it's making it more particularized. And if you make it more particularized, the way we present it, we can understand it. Because it's something which is very central to the perfection of. The way you make it over one particular thing, it becomes a little bit singularized. That's why he was told as an ever. Moreover, it's a little bit difficult even on an ordinary media connected media level. Well, let's say it was just told as an ever. For 2 months, okay? Let's say that. But then it wouldn't be so difficult. But the problem that bothers me is that it's me that connected me to, if he called them Avadim, so now he becomes, you follow? How does that fit the crown? He didn't call them Avadim, he was complaining. In other words, he was trying to defend them, and he was criticizing the brothers for calling them Avadim, okay? So then the punishment should be that maybe that somebody accused him of false testimony or something like that, but here, how do you think that he should be sold as an error to that? That's the brother should have been sold as an error if they were doing it. If Yosef was called an error, then he should. But because he accused the brothers, right? Because he accused the brothers of that, so why is the punishment that he should be sold? And then how does one thing fit the other one? Let's summarize what I've done until now. I'm basing myself very much in line with the sister and but the approach I'm taking is to avoid getting into specifics, you see? I think it's easier that way. Because I don't think it's a way. Why do we have a need to know the particulars? Obviously, they engage in certain behaviors, you see, which could be misinterpreted to give them a status of suspicion. But if the person was Dominic of course, would have not come to such a conclusion. That explains, by the way, why it is defect. And why Yosef did it, let me get that straightened out. Yosef's motive was not the petty base motives of someone who likes to be a Malkin. Again, he did it because he thought it was very important. But he was operating with his distorted view of the brothers and his very high standards, which he wants to impose on everybody. That's why he referred to his father. In his own mind, it was necessary to report to Yaakov. Not to get them in trouble. To correct the situation, because, after all, these are the founders of Klal Yisrael. But Yaakov didn't do anything about it, because Yaakov was much more experienced than his father. He realized that you've got to give them room. And he took it to the view that he was mature and he was teasing them, but he realized that they were very, perfected individuals, but they were young, they were still young, he didn't get carried away by it. That would explain why Yaakov didn't do anything about it. In my opinion, there's certain zealousness for halacha, but it contained an element of perhaps arrogance, distortion of the character of brothers. And that's what he had to overcome. I mean, you see in the end, I mean, he had the sympathetic attitude that he had towards them. Tremendous sympathy for them. In spite of the fact that they then they came to the serious case. And it came to the most serious case, the one which hardly anybody would ever forgive, and in the end he had tremendous sympathy, tremendous understanding. So I mean, he went through a huge transformation over here.